Have you ever noticed how sometimes your insight and words from God come in threes? You know, what is it about three? Well, you know, three is a sacred number and all, but it just seems like things come in threes. And it's probably just because the first time it just blows right past you. The second time it's like, well, could be a coincidence. It's definitely not a trend. But the third time starts to get your attention, you know, and that's kind of what happened to me over the last few days. There were three things in a sequence that sort of cemented what I wanted to talk to you about today. And, wow. Thursday afternoon, I got a chance to sit with a friend of mine that I don't see a whole lot. You know, we're in contact, but we don't get a whole lot of time together. And he's a pastor. But what we needed to talk about was that his daughter overdosed about 4 months ago and died. And I talked to him a couple of times along the way, but this is the first time that we had a chance to just sit down and really talk. You know, for about 2 hours we sat and talked. And it was an interesting conversation, to say the least, and I felt like I was kind of tiptoeing through a minefield because he's still so raw. And when someone is in that state, our natural tendency is to want to fix it, to want to go in there and have the perfect thing to say that's just going to break the clouds over their heads and to make a big difference. And what you realize is that anything that you say or try to say or try to fix merely cheapens the moment. It goes the other direction, because what is there to say when someone's lost their child? You know, what is there that you can do to fix it? There's nothing, you know. And I was really conscious of that as I was listening to him speak and just letting him download and the things that I would talk to him about. I was careful not to sound like a greeting card, you know, and try to just give some platitude that would just make the whole situation worse and so trivialized, you know. But the situation that he's in is even more complex, because although his daughter made the choice to take the pills that were offered to her, she had been sober and clean for such a long time that the person who gave her the pills was really irresponsible in doing so. And it's just amazing when you think that someone would do that so carelessly and casually, and then gave her the dose that overdosed her, and then just put her in his bed on his room and left her overnight. And everything that led up to it was just more and more of an outrage for my friend, and learning how this went down. And of course, first he was angry at himself, you know, the natural thing. Could I have done anything else? Could I have done more? What could I have done to have changed this outcome? And then of course to be mad at her. Why did she make this choice? Why did she do this? She knew better. Then anger at the person who gave her the dose, you know, what was he doing? And then the police have declined to prosecute him. And the outrage of that, you know, that he could do this with impunity, and so now he's angry at the police. And then all these series of resentments, you know, where does the buck stop eventually? You know, he said, I'm angry at God too. How could he let this happen? You know, after everything that we've been through, after everything she's been through, everything I've been through, you know, how could God let this happen? And I asked him, where do you go for comfort? You know, what is it that you're doing right now? Because he said the first 2 months were easier than these last 2 months. And that happens all the time, isn't it? Because when everything is happening and there's everybody around and there's services to prepare and all these things to do, at least you're distracted by that and there's a sense of connection. It's when life starts to go back to what passes for normal and everybody goes home to their houses, that everything starts to set in. And that's where he was at. And he said, you know, it's been tough. You know, we had a vacation planned, he and his wife, and they went and took it, and he thought maybe that would be good, change of scenery, and it was worse, because it took him away from all the things that he was doing to kind of distract himself. And then he comes back, and then dealing with these legal things and all these other issues have just been so difficult. And then I asked him, well, how about your church? You know, has your church been a support? And he said, well, they were at first, and they all gathered around, and they were great. But it was almost like there was a time limit on how quickly he had to heal. You know, it's like it was okay for a little while, but now that he's still, in fact, even getting worse and maybe getting more angry and more bitter at certain aspects of this whole circumstance out there, He senses a growing impatience, and now the platitudes come. You know, he's angry at the pusher, the guy who gave the dose, and someone will say to him something like, "Oh, but God's got him right where he wants him," you know, and that's of no help at all. And like I said, what do you say to someone who is hurting this way? And we want to fix it, and we think we've got the answer. We think we've got the concept of God that is going to be able to be conveyed to the person, and they'll get this insight, and everything will be okay, you know. But it's not okay. And he finds himself questioning everything about his faith, about his vocation, about what he's doing, and he's trying to come up with something that he can hang on to that makes sense, because this does not make sense. Why would this happen? You know, it's. It was hard for me to sit there because on one hand, it was bringing up the crisis in my life where I felt exactly the same as he. But it was nothing as severe. I mean, it was the end of my marriage. I lost my marriage. I didn't lose a child. But I guess it's unfair to compare these things because it was my crisis and it was the thing that brought me to my knees. It was the thing that caused me to question everything that had gone before. And I knew where he was and I knew that feeling and it was all coming back to me. And it was so difficult to just sit and be quiet and try not to offer anything stupid. Just, you know, like the Hippocratic Oath, first, do no harm. That's what I was really thinking. Don't do any harm. Just be supportive. Be there for him. And we talked, and it was a good meeting. But it caused me to start to think about what he was saying in a different way. And he told me that he had a friend that he had met. I don't know if this was before or after his own daughter's death, but this person too had experienced the death of someone close. And in their grief, they turned to him and they said, "I need a bigger God." And I don't know how that sounds to you, but it made perfect sense to me. I need a bigger God. The God that I have imagined, the God that I have been following, the God that I have been taught, is not sufficient to get me through this. I think I'm going to fall. I think I'm going to crack. I need a bigger God. Just yesterday morning, sounds like a song, doesn't it? Just yesterday morning, they let me know you were gone. Suzanne, the plans they made put an end to you. I mean, think about what James Taylor was writing there. I've seen fire and I've seen rain. I've seen lonely days when that I thought would never end. I've seen lonely times when I couldn't find a friend. But I always thought that I'd see you one more time again. He's expressing the same thing. You know, it's like what we so truly believe to be true, when it ends up not true, what do? How do you cope? What happens? You know, you think that this person that you love, your child, you're not supposed to bury your child. They're supposed to bury you. For crying out loud. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with something that just seemed like it was so, you know, permanent in your life and then suddenly it's not? So yesterday morning I was preparing, and I always read the news in the morning, or I try to, and I come across this story that just hit me like a ton of bricks. And I don't know if you've heard about Aaron Shannon. It's a 5-year-old child in South Central LA. Last Sunday on Halloween, put on his costume for the evening. See if I can get through this. Spider-Man, his favorite superhero. And it's got the padded muscles, you know, and he goes into his backyard with his grandfather and his uncle, and he's, you know, he's running around and being Spider-Man, and he's so excited about the night and trick-or-treating, and he's flexing his padded muscles and doing all that. And two gang members come up in the alley behind and open fire on their backyard. And they shoot him in the back of the head, and they kill him. And this wasn't just crossfire, someone getting in the way. They were targeting the family. The police think they were targeting the wrong family. They just went to the wrong house because this family has nothing to do with gangs, has no relatives in gangs. And yet, it doesn't really matter, does it? Somebody thought that it was okay to point a weapon at a 5-year-old in a Spider-Man costume and pull the trigger. And you see, for me, we've got a 6-year-old who was Buzz Lightyear this year. And from the moment he got that costume, I don't think he took it off all the way through Halloween. And he was running around the house, you know, doing all the acrobatics and to infinity and beyond. And he had the laser thing going. And then a couple of days later, Marianne got him the inflatable wings on the back. Then he says, Dad, I can fly. And he's jumping, literally jumping and belly flopping on the carpet. And I said, Brennan, please don't do that off of anything, okay? Don't jump off anything. I could just see him going up the top of the stairs and flying. It's like, oh my gosh. But that's who he was, and that's who this little boy was, you know? And all of this thing just crossed in my heart. And I was thinking, if I was holding the bleeding body of my son, you know, I don't care what I think I know or how much I think that I am prepared. I would need a bigger God because I don't know if I could handle that. I got a text last night from a friend who is being informed that she's probably going to be laid off on Thursday. And she's freaking out, you know, and she's asking the same questions. Why? What's going on? Why would God allow this to happen? Okay, it's just a job, but it really doesn't matter what we lose. Like I said, lose a child, lose a spouse, lose a marriage, lose a job, lose a limb. You know, lose your health. Whatever it is you lose that you thought that you had that you feel is essential to your life and it's gone, how do you deal with that if your God is not the God who is living with you at this moment, if he's only in your head? You know, truly it's not that we need a bigger God or that God could be any bigger, is it? But it is that we've made God too small. We've categorized him. We've imagined him in a certain way, and as soon as we have a thought about God, we've already stepped away from God. As soon as we think we've got him all figured out, that's when he's too small. And so we need another way to look at this. I know I've used this analogy here before, but it's such a good one, I think. I don't know if it speaks to you, but it speaks to me. About the way this works in our lives. You know, back in the 17th century, Isaac Newton developed the laws of mechanics, and for three centuries, that defined the way the world worked. It defined the motion of planets. It defined the motion of anything that moved. And everybody thought, they called them laws, right? They were the way the world worked. Until speeds got up close to the speed of light, and then everything fell apart. And then Newton's laws didn't work anymore. So enter Einstein with his theories of relativity. And he can describe the way things work close to the speed of light or at the speed of light. But then when we were able to go down to the subatomic particle and see those particles, suddenly Einstein's theories didn't work anymore. So enter quantum mechanics, which describes the way those subatomic particles work and how they can wink in and out of existence and do all these completely impossible-seeming and counterintuitive things. And that worked for a while until we started to really look at dynamic and complex systems like the weather and realizing we should be able to predict it, but how right is your weatherman? And realizing that chaos theory has to describe that, that tiny changes in the input conditions of things, the initial conditions of things, yields huge outputs. And so here we've got this moving wave front of what we think we know. And the mistake is to think that at any point along the way, we've got it all figured out. Because all that means is we haven't pushed it to the extremes yet. See, what you believe about God is okay as long as your life is a certain temperature, a certain velocity. You know, things aren't going too badly and everything seems to be in place. But push it to the extremes. Lose a child, lose a limb, lose a job, lose something that you never thought would go away. And then see what happens. See if your theory, see if your theology, your doctrine, your understanding, your concept still holds water, still gets you through. Theology is a tricky thing. Theology is a concept about God that is supposed to take us to an experience of God. Not to be an end in itself, and certainly not to be God in itself. An ancient Chinese philosopher said, you know, the purpose of a fish trap is to catch a fish. Once the fish is caught, the trap is forgotten. The purpose of a rabbit snare is to catch a rabbit. Once the rabbit is caught, the snare is forgotten. The purpose of words is to convey ideas. Once the ideas are grasped, then the words are forgotten. And he says, show me the man who has forgotten words. He's the one I want to talk to. And to that I would add that the purpose of theology is to catch God, to move into a relationship and experience of him. And once that experience is grasped, then the theology can be forgotten. So I'm looking for someone who's forgotten theology. That's the one I want to talk to. We have to realize that theology and God are not the same thing. The map and the territory are not the same thing. The concept and the reality are not the same thing. It's just a mental construct. It's what we imagine. And that's good. We need to do that. We need to have something. I'm not saying throw away your beliefs, but I'm saying remember that your beliefs are only a placeholder. And as soon as you step away from the actual real-time experience of God and have a thought in your mind, you've already taken a step away. You know? Again, in Chinese, the way, the same way of Jesus that we conceive of as the way is not, the way that can be named is not the eternal way, is the way they put it. As soon as we put a name to it, as soon as we've said the name, we've already limited it. There's one reason the Jews didn't speak the name of their God. Because in no way would they limit it. In no way would they show dominion over their God. And we need to realize that this is important. Theology is not God. Theology is a vehicle to get us to God. In the same way, the message is in the bottle. The message is not the bottle itself. Someone puts a message in a bottle and casts it out on the sea, and you find it on the beach, and you find this bottle, and it's so beautiful, and you love the way it's weathered and the color of it, and you put it up on your mantle, and you dust it off, and you look at it every day. Isn't that beautiful? The purpose of that bottle is to break it and take out the message and find out what the message is, you see. God's message is the same way. We need to make sure that we don't confuse the container for the content. Leonard Sweet puts it beautifully in his book, Aqua Church. He says, he makes the distinction between the content and the container, and he says, the mystery of the gospel is this. It is always the same. The content is always the same. And it is always changing, the container. In fact, one of the ways you know the old truths are true is their ability to assume amazing and unfamiliar shapes while remaining themselves and without compromising their integrity. Martin Luther said something interesting too. He said, if you preach the gospel in all aspects, with the exception of the issues that deal specifically with your time, you're not preaching the gospel at all. See, we have made the mistake of not recognizing that Jesus' message is eternal. His word is eternal. He poured it into the lives of his friends. And it's kind of like water. Water will take the shape of whatever container you pour it into, right? Pour it into a glass, it looks like a glass. Pour it into one of those weird, ornate vases, and it looks like that. Pour it into anything. Jesus poured his word, poured his truth into his followers, and it looked like them. It looked like their time. It looked like first century Judea. It looked like their culture because it was poured into their lives, and it filled all the nooks and crannies and filled their lives. And then it filled Paul's life. And as he moved into the Gentile world and all the churches that he was establishing and maintaining, and he poured that truth into their lives, their container, and it was shaped like them. And so we read that word now, and we take it frozen in its first century form and want to jam it into our lives, literally, like the square peg into the round hole, and it doesn't fit. What we need to do is to take that truth and hold it close, let it melt, become liquid again, pour it into our lives. Same truth, it's still water, it's still gospel, it's still God, but now it fills and flows into our lives. This is what each one of us needs to do. If we're going to find our bigger God, if we're going to find the experience of the God that we need to get through the difficult things in our lives, this is the process. The gospel will look endlessly different as it moves through each one of our lives in each generation, in each time. But the truth remains the same as long as that's what we're looking for. In other words, God is never hearsay. God is never second person or third person. If you got it from somebody else, you are simply taking their form, their shape, their container, and trying to plop it on top of your life. And that's not enough. As soon as God's name is spoken, as I said, we've taken a step away. It's only a part of the truth. It's a reflection of it. And when it comes right down to it, the only thing that we can transfer from one of us to another is information. We can transfer head knowledge. We can't transfer experience. If any one of our musicians up here wants to give you their ability to play an instrument, is that possible? They can give you the head knowledge. They can talk to you about music theory. They can talk to you about the way their instrument works and finger position and all that sort of thing. But until you spend the time with the instrument, nothing will be gained. You won't be able to play. You won't be able to experience what music really is until you're actually in it and doing it for some time. It's the way it is with our God. We can't just learn Him. We have to do Him. We have to be in relationship with Him. He can't be conveyed that way. He can't be stored. It's like the manna. It's only good for the day, right? Every day we recommit ourselves to these things. And so I guess the question becomes then, how can we experience this bigger God? How can we experience what it is we're talking about? There's a clue. And if you've got your handouts, take a look at Luke 10, 25 to 29. Very famous section. This is the Good Samaritan. It's the preamble to the Good Samaritan. A lawyer stood up and put him to the test, saying, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" And he said to him, "What is written in the law? How does it read to you?" And he answered, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." And Jesus said to him, "You have answered correctly. Do this and you will live." But wishing to justify himself, he said to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" And of course, Jesus, being the rabbi that he was, doesn't answer him directly. He tells him a story about a man who was thrown in with robbers and left to die in the gutter. And the priest and the Levite go by and don't help, but it's a Samaritan of all people who stops to help. But the point here, who is my neighbor, is the clue that I'm looking for right now. And what is neighbor? Who's your neighbor? Who is your neighbor? I mean, Jesus' point was that it was the Samaritan, the one that was most hated in that culture, that was the neighbor to the man who was injured. Who is your neighbor? What do you think that means? In the original languages, even in English, neighbor in English comes from the Middle English nibor, nigh. You know, stay by my cradle till morning is nigh. It means near. A nibor, a neighbor, is someone who is near. Same thing in the Greek. Plesion in the Greek means one who is near, close in proximity. And especially kariba in Aramaic means exactly that. The one who is close to you. And here's the kicker. A neighbor has nothing to do with relationship. Doesn't mean you're in relationship. Doesn't mean you even know the person. Doesn't mean you're family or friend. Doesn't mean that you're enemy or anything else. It just simply means the one who is close by. The one who is in your path. That's it. We are commanded to love the one who is close by. The one who is directly in front of us. So, are we commanded to love the one who is far away? The one who is remote? Think about that for a second. How can you, how do you love someone who is not with you and is remote? Do you think nice thoughts about them? Do you include them in your prayers? That's great. Do you support missionaries financially so that they can go and do the good things for these people in another continent, other side of the world? That's great. But are you loving them? Is that what we mean by love? See, the Jews were absolutely concrete, absolutely practical. And what they realized is that when we take love and we take it out into the abstract, what's happening anymore? Love requires a direct object. Love requires a lover and a beloved. And there has to be an interaction. There has to be some exchange. When James says faith without works is dead, he's speaking about that exchange. What does it mean to say you have faith if there's no exchange, if there's nothing happening, if there's no object to your faith, if there's no works, if there's nothing going on? You see, love is the same way. Love and faith are intimately related that way. We can only, if you really think about it, in the biblical definition, love the one we're with. Can't do it any other way. It is that absolute connection that is really what is going on. And when we do the opposite, and we do it all the time, don't we? Because it's so much easier to love the one who's remote. Because now we have reduced love to an abstract thought. We've reduced it to just some sort of concept in our minds. And we can say that we're loving those people in some abstract way, and we're missing the day-to-day interaction with those who are right in front of us. I think Mother Teresa got this better than anybody, and I wanted to read a few quotes from her and see what she says and see if it makes sense to you. She says, "It's easy to love the people far away. It's not always easy to love those close to us. It's easier to give a cup of rice to relieve hunger than to relieve the loneliness and pain of someone unloved in our own home. Bring love into your home, for this is where our love for each other must start." Jesus said, "Love one another." He didn't say love the whole world. How do you love the whole world? It's an abstract concept. It means nothing. It means some feeling that you might have, but what can you do? How do you act? Well, you can love the whole world by loving the one that's right in front of you, and that's what she's basically saying. Love one another. Don't love the whole world. If you can't feed 100 people, then feed just one. Each of them, each one of them is Jesus in disguise. Love begins by taking care of the closest ones, the ones at home. And it's not how much we do, but how much love we put into that action. We think sometimes that poverty is only being hungry, naked, and homeless. The poverty of being unwanted, unloved, and uncared for is the greatest poverty. We must start in our own homes to remedy this kind of poverty. I want you to be concerned about your next-door neighbor. Do you know your next-door neighbor? In this life, we cannot do great things. We can only do small things with great love. Do not think that love, in order to be genuine, has to be extraordinary. What we need is to love without getting tired. She writes that, "I'm not sure exactly what heaven will be like, but I do know that when we die and it comes time for God to judge us, he will not ask how many good things have you done in your life. Rather, he will ask how much love did you put into what you did. Spread love everywhere you go. Let no one ever come to you without leaving happier. Every time you smile at someone, it is an action of love, a gift to that person, a beautiful thing. Peace begins with a smile. Let us always meet each other with a smile, for the smile is the beginning of love. We shall never know all the good things that a simple smile can do." And she says, "One of the greatest diseases is to be nobody to anybody." And this final one, that's a little off point, but I just love it. I'm going to read it anyway. She says, "We, the unwilling, led by the unknowing, are doing the impossible for the ungrateful. We have done so much for so long with so little, we are now qualified to do anything with nothing." Do you see where she's going with this, of course, though? Do you see what the point is? We use our abstract love as a diversion, as a way of avoiding the person that's right in front of us. And yet it's the person in front of us, when that exchange takes place, that something also takes place inside our spirit. When we connect with that person in front of us, to the exclusion of whatever else may be going on, remote from us, we are connecting with the Spirit of our God in a way that we will never do otherwise. We can only love that person, not anyone else. But that somehow isn't satisfying sometimes. What we really want are big answers to big questions, isn't it? We want these big theological answers because they're kind of like an insurance policy. If we can get that question answered, then we can remove some of the risk about the decision that we need to make right now. And so we keep looking for those answers. And we imagine that these big answers are somehow going to solve all the problems of our life, take away the stress and the anxiety, make things better. Well, here's the truth. Today's answer is tomorrow's platitude. The answer you get today and try to store it up for future becomes something that you put on a greeting card. And even though it's true, and I'm not saying it's not true, it's still absolutely unhelpful when you need a bigger God. It's not going to work. If we believe that our answer, whatever it is, whatever we believe about God, about religion and doctrine, if we believe that's the whole truth, then we've created a small God. It's just like this picture on your handouts. As big as that effigy may be, As soon as it's carved, as soon as it's cast, as soon as it's poured, as soon as it's set in stone, it's already too small. The God who can take us through everything is the living, breathing God that we meet in real time, in the moment. It's hard for us to understand that what we want to do is to acquire more understanding about God. And we think that's the road of our spiritual journey. When really what it's about is a letting go of the understanding you think you already have. Does that make sense? Can you see that? We want more understanding, but understanding is our enemy in terms of finding the bigger God in real time. The more we think we understand, the more we put God in the box. And then we think that's the whole thing. That's Him. When we can let go of that, that's when things start to happen. And I think that's really what Paul is dealing with here in 1 Corinthians 13. And you all know this chapter. It's the famous love chapter. And I put the whole thing in the handout because it's so beautiful and it forms this incredible, complete thought. But the one that I want to deal with is just the third paragraph, starting at verse 11. He says, "When I was a child, I used to speak like a child, think like a child, reason like a child. When I became a man, I did away with childish things. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I will know fully, just as I have also been fully known. But now faith, hope, love abide these three. But the greatest of these is love." And what I want to focus on here is that when I was a child, I used to think like a child. How does a child think? A child thinks they understand it all. They've got it all together. Any of you have teenagers? All right? They know better than you, don't they? They got it all figured out, don't they? Didn't we, when we were that age and looking at our parents as irrelevant know-nothings? The child thinks they've got it together. They think they understand what's going on. The adult knows that he or she doesn't. That all you have is part of the truth. It's part of being mature is to recognize your limitations, right? To understand that whatever truth you have, it's only part of the truth. Now we see through the mirror dimly, but then, face to face, someday we'll get the rest of the dose, but right now it's not available. Now we only know in part. Later we'll get the greater part. We have to realize that what we know is only a fraction, and that there is a God, a complete God, that we can meet in our moments, of connection with each other and Him directly, spirit to spirit, that gives us a glimpse, but we can't hold on to it. And we certainly can't hold on to it in our minds. We can't keep thinking about it. We need to constantly re-experience God and move through that, regardless of what's happening in our life. And to me, that's hope. As soon as you realize that you can rest in the unknowing part, that you don't know it all, and you realize that God is full of the fullness of mercy and compassion and justice, that anything that you see here that's still wrong will be made right. Everything will resolve in Him, that nothing is ever lost. Remember the conservation of energy and matter? Nothing is ever lost, it just changes form. Remember that from school? It's the same way with us. Nothing is ever lost. Everything will resolve in God. That's our hope. The faith is the ability to walk out of this door and live our lives as if that's true. It's not the thought in our head. It's the choices we make. It's everything we do consistently. The faith and the hope and the love is that connection between each of us and each other. And it's like a full circle. Is it the love that comes first, or the faith and the hope, or the faith? You know, it doesn't matter, because really they're all expressions of the same thing. It's the oneness of God. It's the connection with Him moment by moment. This is what we have in our God. And if we will just abandon the things we think we know, we can move into the hugeness of that connection, that well-being, and that oneness that God is offering us. Let's pray. Father, there's many of us that are going through difficult things in our lives right now. I know that directly, and I just know it by inference. And for any of us who need you to be bigger, for any of us who are struggling with what we thought was our faith, with the wreckage of our faith, help us to move into this place by understanding that it's in this moment that we will start to experience who you really are, start to experience the truth that you have for us that will take us to a place of freedom. Help us to be willing to risk letting go of all the things we think we know so that we can just, without any expectation, just meet you, to fall into your embrace and to know what that means, even if it's for the first time. Father, you are awesome. You are beyond all expectation. Thank you for who you are. Help us to just enter into that and find out how big you really are. Thank you, Lord. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.